Interview with Daniel Ellsberg, April 18th, 2022.
Recording in progress.
All right. So, yeah, I mean, what I wanted to do, I wanted to check in with you. You know, obviously, last time we talked, we talked around your birthday and we talked around a range of issues. This time around, you're obviously somebody who's written about and thought an awful lot about the risks of nuclear war, intentional or accidental. And I was hoping you could talk me through some of your thoughts about, you know, what the Ukrainian war means internationally, what the risks are of this spilling over, you know, just your thoughts analyzing this about how this could proceed.
Well, as the world has correctly perceived, this has seeds of regional nuclear war and of all-out war between the U.S. and Russia. There's more attention to it probably than there has been for a very long time for most people other than me and some colleagues of mine. I've been concerned about this for most of my life now. I'm 91, and since 1958 I've been obsessed. When I went to work for RAND as a consultant then, full-time employee the next year, I was working on the dangers of the nuclear war and trying to reduce them, and I've been doing it ever since. That even underlay my concern about Vietnam when I copied the Pentagon Papers, because I knew that Nixon was heading toward an escalation which could lead to nuclear war in Vietnam. What I didn't know in 1969 when I copied them was that Nixon was making threats of nuclear first use in Vietnam. That year, and that he had actually issued what amounted to a nuclear ultimatum in September and October of that year, 69, leading toward a possible or even likely use of nuclear weapons. A month after I'd copied this, started copying the Pentagon Papers. I didn't know that. But anyway, we looked back on that, and Nixon was using nuclear weapons at that time by threatening first use. The way, as I've often said, that you use a gun when you point it at someone's head in a confrontation. If you can get what you want without pulling the trigger, and Nixon did not get that, but if you do get that, that's the best use of the gun, and you couldn't make that threat if you didn't have it. So we've often used our nuclear weapons that way. And what's new now is that Russia is doing the same. It's funny in a way for me, but not funny, very unfunny for me, in that we're in the world now that my colleagues at RAND and I thought we were in when I started upon this problem in 1958, until I learned sooner than any of my RAND colleagues in 1961 that we weren't in that world. I'll define it. A world in which we then saw totalitarian, but an imperial power, the Soviet Union then, had as many or more, we thought, nuclear weapons, ICBMs, than we did, and was more likely to make nuclear threats than I imagined we were, and that he was, in effect, making those threats as we were over Berlin, and in 62, both sides were, except that there was only one nuclear superpower there. We had an immense, vast capability to annihilate Soviet military bases and the population. Khrushchev had actually an ability to annihilate Europe, but not with his short-range and medium-range weapons of the kind that Gorbachev and Reagan banned in 1987, which he had then. and which, of course, the U.S. first and then Putin, Trump and Putin, abandoned that that ban 2 years ago. Okay, coming back. He did have that threat against Europe, but it didn't seem to worry us in our dealings over Berlin or Cuba, because he couldn't annihilate the U.S. In 1961, the commander of SAC, have you read my book, I think?
Oh, yes. Yes, I have.
So you know that I'm saying, recapitulating that. But I knew by September 1961, in August of 1961, I learned that the commander of Strategic Air Command believed there was 1,000 Russian ICBMs. We had 40 plus. We had about 4,200 Polaris missiles for IRBM sub-launch. We had IRBMs in Turkey and elsewhere, UK. And we had thousands of planes, tactical and other. He didn't have anything like that. He had 4 ICBMs. So the world of Herman Kahn, my colleague at RAND, in his book on thermonuclear war, very much attention in 1960, was a world, he assumed, like the rest of us at RAND, of 2 nuclear superpowers, very similar, each with a first strike capability, each with a first use capability, first strike being against the enemy's homeland and all of his military bases. Very similar, capabilities on a hair trigger, launch on warning, but there was only one at that time, and that's a major reason why the war didn't occur at that time or since the nuclear war. There was only one at that point. Now there are 2. And whereas before the fall of the Soviet Union, the USSR, they had an immense conventional capability, actually not larger than NATO's, but we thought it was very large. No reason for them to threaten first use, because in Europe, they had a conventional capability, at least comparable, if not superior. That's no longer true, on the one hand. So almost for 30 years, Russia has been imitating Eisenhower's new look, going back to 53, where you rely on first use of nuclear weapons. You integrate them into the forces, you build new ones, and you threaten that if you're faced with any defeat or setback, you can initiate nuclear war. They've been moving toward that for 30 years precisely because they don't have a conventional superiority anymore, with the loss of the Warsaw Pact and their own forces being much smaller. We've continued, we've never varied from our reliance on the threats of the first use of nuclear weapons. That's the basis of NATO. And it has been the basis of our alliance. By the way, you look a little sleepy, am I mistaken? Am I putting you to sleep here?
No, I'm writing very carefully.
Oh, okay. No, your eyes are...
I'm looking down because I'm writing.
Oh, I thought I'm losing. Okay, now I'll go. I think it's the wrong answer to your question, but it's the big question now. Okay. We've never parted from that, because we wanted a sphere of influence that wasn't limited to the Caribbean or Latin America, the Monroe Doctrine, where we've always had a proclaimed sphere of influence and acted on it. But we wanted a sphere of influence since 1945 that went up to the borders of Soviet control, and after 49, Chinese communist control, right up to their border. That's thousands of miles from us, unlike, let's say, Ukraine from Russia, or for that matter, Germany from Russia. Thousands of miles away, we wanted a sphere of predominant influence and hegemony. And to do that, we relied on our first monopoly of nuclear weapons, and then at our efforts to maintain a major superiority, which we thought we didn't have at various times, but we always had it, until fairly recently, until late Brezhnev, in effect. But and then it went way down for quite a while. Putin built that up again, and he has a very comparable force to ours now, and he's now using it the way we've used it dozens of times. So just as Herman Kahn, a name that probably people now don't even remember, but the older ones will, he said, in effect, thermonuclear war has to be taken as a fact of life. It's reality. It may well happen. It may have to happen. We have to be prepared for it. We have not only to threaten it, but to be able to survive it and win it. And as I say, that was no relation to the reality half a century ago or 70 years ago when I got into this. Let's see, what is 58? And 20, well, I can't do the arithmetic anymore, being 91, but it's a lot. It's like 70 years, pretty much. So, let's see, 60 would be, for me, 60 would be 62 years now, 63 years. It's 58, if I'm not mistaken. Or a little more than that, 64 years, okay. So, didn't have existed then, it exists now. So you have two doomsday machines, meaning a capability because of nuclear winter, which we didn't know about until 30 years ago. Pardon me, 40 years, 39 years ago, 1983. We just didn't know about nuclear winter, which means that it makes no difference who goes first. Nearly, not everybody, but nearly everyone on Earth dies by starvation, if not from blasts and fire and epidemics in the first week or two. But within a year, the firestorms on the cities that we've always targeted on both sides will send hundreds of millions of tons of smoke and soot into the stratosphere where it won't burn out, rain out, and which will go around the globe very quickly, killing all harvests in the world, south and north, east and west, and destroying food supply. And the current supplies will run out in months. And within a year or so, nearly everyone dies, except for some people in the southern, near the Antarctic, in New Zealand, Australia, who can live on fish and mollusks with less deprivation of sunlight than the rest of the world. So it doesn't kill everybody, just nearly everybody. 90%, maybe 99%. That means a lot of people, but it murders 6 or 7 billion people. Both sides have had that capability, not unknowingly, at least since nuclear winter. Before 1983, I think both sides thought that a nuclear war would kill maybe a billion and a half people. Now, in 1961, when I was working on the war plans, that was a third of the world's population. As I say now, we know it would be closer to the three-thirds that we get. So, this is what we prepared, rehearsed, planned, bought, and us, since 1945, and the Russians, really a big capability, mainly under Brezhnev, starting in 64, after being humiliated in the Cuban Missile Crisis. And they were determined not to be humiliated and have to back down again, and they wrongly interpreted that to having not had as many nuclear weapons as the U.S. That was mistaken. But that was the way their military thought. So they... Brezhnev said what he wanted. They'd helped him get into power. And they said, we want what the U.S. has. And they got it. So Putin has rebuilt it and is processing of modernizing it, just as we are. So that's where we are. Two doomsday machines, both on hair triggers, both with vulnerable ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, which is, like I say, only one had 50 years ago. But now they both have them. Both on launch on warning.
Sorry, both what?
Both are on a policy of launch on warning or launch under attack, which means prepared or planning to send off, launch their ICBMs within minutes of getting an electronic or radar warning or satellite warning that an enemy attack may be on the way. Because otherwise, they stand to lose those ICBMs. Not their sub-launch missiles. Neither are vulnerable. We have more anti-submarine warfare than they do, much more, but not enough to protect us from being annihilated by their submarines, which we can't target. But we can take their ICBMs off the board if we launch fast enough in the face of what may be mistaken warning, as it has been. Each side has had false alarms repeatedly. Not too dangerous if there's no crisis going on, because it's hard to believe the other side is striking you. But in a crisis, like the Cuban Missile Crisis, if they'd had ICBMs, very dangerous. What we're in now, potentially very dangerous. Now, here's a point that I haven't seen anybody else make. Bring this up. Putin is using his nuclear weapons, including his strategic weapons, very effectively now to keep the U.S. from actively, directly participating in the defense of a democratic country to which we're very friendly, almost an ally, which has been subject to unprovoked aggression by, in this case, Russia. Now, looking at our television today, and as Patricia keeps telling me, she's 84 approaching, she's never seen scenes like this. Almost no American has. We didn't see what we were doing to Vietnam, or Iraq, for that matter, or Afghanistan. So, and those are the wars, big wars before this. And it's agonizing to watch, especially a nation that we have very friendly relations with, a democratic nation, being pulverized like this, civilians. It isn't as though these are the first civilians being targeted. I have been, when I heard that these are the first war crimes in the firm.
I've been so blown away by the lack of history when people say that.
Yeah. Well, here's what I'm burdened with, being 91. Even you, how old are you?
I'm 50. But I read a huge amount of history.
But you haven't seen that much on TV, right?
No.
Also, here's another thing. The people we were polarizing were in Vietnam and in Afghanistan and in Iraq had a number of differences, even if we'd seen the pictures. They're not white Christians, and they were led by dictators. So although we had no legitimacy whatever in bombing them, it didn't seem so bad. We didn't care. Americans didn't care about them, you could say. Anyway, whatever the reason, they didn't show that they were caring about them. Now we're seeing a democratic country of white Christians being demolished from here in the way that has happened so often before, mainly by us. And that includes World War II. People think there's inevitably a racist feature to that, as in Japan, and there was. But we were doing the same thing in Germany. We were trying to form firestorms. Let me make a little point here. Firestorms with conventional bombs and incendiaries are very hard to stop. And although we tried to get a firestorm, that is a storm so intense that it lofts smoke into the stratosphere, hard to do that with incendiaries. We've tried almost every time, and we only succeeded in Germany where there was no racist aspect. Remember, they're not only white, but we get a huge German emigre population here. And they were just like us. We couldn't say that we were dehumanizing them. They were like us. And we caused firestorms for the first time in history in Hamburg and then Dresden. We tried in Berlin, but unlike Tokyo, their houses are made of concrete and they were further apart. I should say plaster and concrete. So we only killed, quote, I'm saying that compared to Tokyo, 25,000 Germans in one night in a raid in Berlin in February 1945. The German population over here accepted that. I don't know how much they knew about it. In Tokyo, where the Huns are...
You said February 1945?
What? That was 45. February 1945. Berlin. Didn't get a firestorm. We did in Dresden, and we did in Hamburg, and killed many tens of thousands of people. In Tokyo, in one night, we killed over 100,000 people, or to give a range, 80,000 to 120,000 people burned to death and or suffocated by the loss of oxygen in one night. And that set us up for planning in the nuclear era to do the same thing with one bomb, as in Hiroshima, that it took 300 bombers otherwise. But we had 300 bombers, so we were trying to do that to every city in a row, 64 cities in Japan. But we didn't actually get another big firestorm, hard to do, until Hiroshima. Every nuclear weapon creates a firestorm. That is this intense heat that rofts everything up into the stratosphere. So that's where we are. But having killed 100,000 people in one night and trying to do the same every other night after, I say, or every night, but you know, sometimes they had to take a break for a day. We killed probably 900,000 Japanese before Hiroshima in these raids. As you know, you read in my book, I read that and elsewhere. So the atom bomb to us didn't change the policy of trying to kill as many civilians, humans, as possible. It just made it cheaper. It was more efficient. And so we've planned on that ever since. So we've had this first use policy. And you know, people call it, when Nixon used it as a threat, didn't succeed. He called it his madman policy. But what was mad about it? He was making the threat in the first instance against North Vietnamese. They didn't have any nuclear weapons, so it wasn't any worry that they would retaliate. Now the Chinese could conceivably, they had nuclear weapons, but why would they, court annihilation? So there really wasn't much risk of it. Again, the Russians could have retaliated. But to assure that neither the Russians nor the Chinese, especially the Russians, did retaliate, and to show them we weren't afraid of their retaliating, he put the Strategic Air Command on alert, a flying alert, an air alert, and he dispersed bombers to cities where an accident could have wiped out Boston or Philadelphia, or an accident on the runway. He wanted this to be known to the Russians, but not to the American people, because it would worry them. But why did he think he had to appear mad to do that? Well, really only because it would create a precedent that people would be worried about, rightly worried about, and it would kill too many people in the eyes of Americans. So how mad is that? You know, it's a little more, but if it succeeded in winning the war, it wouldn't have been all that mad. But let me go in the strategic terms of the administration. But let me now make a much broader context that brings us right up to date. In that sense, at least, and really, in the sense since 49 of evoking retaliation, every nuclear threat against the nuclear weapons fleet, a state that has nuclear weapons, to which there are nine, is a threat of a mad action. Insane, evil, possibly blowing up the world and the world's population, but at least, you know, killing vast numbers of people if there's any retaliation. It's insane. So you're threatening an insane action. We have had nothing but a madman policy since Harry Truman. Nothing. All of our nuclear threats are the threats of an insane action. Now, the next question is, is it insane and evil and illegitimate to make the threats? Well, we've assumed it wasn't. It was legitimate to make them, quite openly. And people have accepted that. There have been movements against nuclear testing, but actually a movement against nuclear threats, ever. And up to today. Okay, so, I know I'm going on more here, but I can bring it down very specifically now. To base our alliances on the threat of initiating nuclear war against a nuclear-armed state like Russia or China, not Iran, and that's not nuclear, but Russia or China, as I say, is hard to make credible because it looks as though it might kill everybody, which it would. So to make it credible, you really have to go to some effort to make it look as though you're really ready to carry that out. So you buy the weapons, like buying the gun for a nine, for somebody who holds up a 7-Eleven. You load the weapons. You don't let it leak out that you have no intention of using them. You put them on alert. You put them on launch on warning. You spend trillions of dollars on these to carry out those threats. And that, frankly, makes it fairly credible. Say, well, it would be crazy to do it, but they look as though they're really ready to do it. And if you backed off from that, the credibility would be less, and our alliances would be less reliable because our alliances are based on our will, on our ability and commitment to initiate nuclear war in the defense of allies thousands of miles away. And that's what our whole alliance policy speaks of. Now, why do we do that? Because it gives us a role of protector of Europe and a role in all of their economic councils and their social hegemony, basically, in West Europe, that you wouldn't have otherwise. Strictly speaking, we're not a European power. So how do we get this predominant power in Europe? How is it that up till the present, every commander of NATO has been American? We don't have the most troops. We don't have the, we're not European. Why is the SACEUR, head of Europe, NATO, always American? And the answer is because he wields the nuclear weapon. Now, since 1991, we have lacked an enemy to defend against, and until recently, until the last couple of months or the last couple of years. So NATO had no real rationale or purpose for existing since 1991, as Russia has pointed out from time to time. Well, that's serious. Why does Europe, why NATO is America's Cosa Nostra, our thing. The Mafia's our thing, Cosa Nostra. The European Union is not, it's European. Actually, we're not part of it. And for Ukraine or whoever, Poland, to be in the European Union as they want to be, that doesn't give us a commanding role over them. NATO does. It's the only institution that does. And actually, we control a number of others pretty much, like the IMF and the World Bank. But in military terms, I mean, in close terms, that's U.S. in Europe. Makes us a predominant European power. Without Russia, how do you rationalize that? And how do you sell weapons to to Europe. How do you sell F-22s, F-35s to Poland or Germany, the other people who got up, if Russia isn't an enemy? And Lockheed had salesmen in Poland before the Warsaw Pact dissolved, according to Andrew Coburn in his book Spoils of War. Lockheed had sales pitches going on in Poland from the time the wall came down in 89, 2 years before the Warsaw Pact. So Russia is the indispensable enemy of NATO. And, you know, for two decades, sort of, it didn't look like an enemy. So NATO had to say, well, we're against terror. Well, you don't really need protection of nuclear. It's hard to sell nuclear submarines against ISIS. Okay, China. But China wasn't ready yet. And to say that NATO is against China, which we do, has a slightly absurd ring to it. So there is a silver lining to Putin's aggression in America and NATO for the American military-industrial complex. In fact, it's almost indispensable. But they couldn't have brought it about by themselves, of course. But it is an incredible benefit to them in terms of profit and sales, which we're seeing already, immediately. How do you rationalize a $780 billion defense budget? Well, how about an $820 billion defense budget? Or what some people are talking about, I think Albert Colby and some, $1 trillion. I don't know if he's the one somebody has talked about. We're not far from that. 820 is not so far from $1 trillion defense budget. How, without Ukraine, could you get that? And by the way, that money goes to American firms. We're not hiring our defenses. We're not buying them. They're buying them, other people. So it's, there are people for whom this war is a godsend. And whether or not they consciously moved toward it, and it's very clear they were risking it, consciously risking it for 40 years. How do you sell these weapons, which constitute, as Russia sees, weapons on their own national border? So by definition, a security problem. How do you sell those if Russia isn't a bad guy? Well, Putin is a bad guy now, very clearly. Whatever he was earlier, everybody can see that now. His aggression is as murderous and illegitimate as the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan or the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq or Hitler's invasion of Poland. You know, up until now, by the way, the first person who invoked an analogy to Hitler lost the discussion, right? That was well-known rhetorical problem. To compare anybody to Hitler, ends the, you know, you're out of play. That's not true now. It's absolutely routine, and with reason. It really is the same as Hitler's invasion of Cuba, or our invasion of Iraq. And as you know, we were just saying about it earlier, in terms of murderousness against civilians, Iraq and Afghanistan and Vietnam by the U.S., as you know, and I know, was as, we haven't reached that level remotely yet. As a matter of fact, Russia hasn't remotely reached what it did to Afghanistan civilians in 10 years. So historically, you know, analogical, and I'll tell you, when I was reading in the last month, American officials and commentators saying, there's been no analogy to this in Europe or in the world until since World War II. Frankly, it makes me feel faint
Yeah, I read Tom Friedman saying that. I was stunned. I wrote a column on Friedman saying that. The level of historical amnesia.
Well, that's for sure. But here's my problem. I'm 91. So I'm burdened with an awful lot of historical analyses in my lifetime, in many of which I participated on one side or the other. I was a participant in the nuclear arms buildup, which was a moral catastrophe. And I was an active participant in the Vietnam War, which was a moral catastrophe. And then I was a resistant or a protester or a dissenter or whatnot in Iraq and Afghanistan, and really very sympathetic to our support of the jihad, Mount Mujahideen, in Afghanistan. At that time. In fact, I thought, why does it have to be a covert program? It could be a perfectly open program. It's legitimate. They invaded. They occupied. Well, you know, what's come of that, by the way, 9/11, Al-Qaeda, it wasn't a totally prudent involvement. But here's where it gets very, very close to the present. As I read this, studying it night and day, obsessively, the way I am wont to do in situations, I know that the U.S. has been preparing for an insurgency or guerrilla operations in Ukraine since Russia went into the Donbass in 2014. Our special forces have been training in this country and in Ukraine and elsewhere Ukrainians for guerrilla war operations if they were occupied, meaning that we were well aware that that was a possibility, and it was assumed that there wouldn't be any major, defense or opposition to the occupation. That would take over quickly, cakewalk and so forth. Well, everybody was wrong on that. But so what they were preparing for was an insurgency. Now, there's a footnote here. That may have served the Ukrainians well in the last month, because they may well have been using kind of guerrilla tactics in terms of, mobility and striking from unexpected places and exploiting vulnerabilities, etc. They may have been acting with the help of helicopters and other things. Our training may have helped them on that. But if the Russians were to expand, as they tried to do, into a full occupation, which is what we expected, and I'll just say parenthetically, which our policy was always making more likely, explicitly. Our policy in almost every respect was heightening the probability of an illegitimate aggression by Putin in Ukraine, and we knew that. And did we actually desire that? It's possible, more than possible. But at the very least, we knew we were consciously risking that, and we, quote, accepted that risk. And why not? Because it's a perfect situation for Cold Warriors. We needed another Cold War for NATO, for our own role in Europe and the world, and for our sales, billions and billions of dollars of sales were there from the military-industrial complex. So we've been moving toward the Cold War for years, and the knowledge that when it came to Ukraine, that was really risking an illegitimate war by Russia against Ukraine. We knew that. Just as Khrushchev was risking our aggression in 1962, when he put Russian troops and surface-to-air missiles and missiles into Cuba. That didn't give us any slight legitimacy of attacking Cuba. But, was that pretty predictable or not? And in the same way, he almost got away with it, by the way, that's another story. But he was risking it, and he lost the gamble. Well, cannon, first definer of the Cold War, of containment. George Kennan was saying in 1995 and 1997, the expansion you're planning and moving toward of NATO is the most historic blunder since the end of the Cold War. And he could almost have said, you know, since the end of World War II, there are others he would be competing with there. But certainly in the 21st centuries, or he wasn't yet in the 21st, since 1921, this is the greatest blunder, terrible. Jack Matloff, Reagan and Bush's ambassador to Moscow, very experienced, was saying in 1997, you must not do this, it would be a strategic mistake because it will do implicitly two things. But the thing he mentioned was, it will make collaboration with Russia impossible, as we know, and it will move them toward, it will strengthen the reactionary, religious, nationalistic, militaristic elements in Russia, which existed then and now are pretty much in control. And implicitly, actually nobody said this, you're risking invasion of Ukraine. By the way, just a footnote, I think it's quite interesting. I think almost nobody who opposed NATO expansion went to the point of saying they'll invade. So on this point, Biden's intelligence came through quite well. You and I know people, I'm sure, and have been reading people, who couldn't believe that Russia would invade right up to the 24th of February. That included Jack Matloff, by the way. He said, no one more experienced in the country knew Putin, and says, on the 22nd of February, I cannot imagine a Russian invasion of Ukraine, which took place 2 days later. And it just, you know, people didn't seem to imagine that. But Biden did have it. From September and October on, in November, they were predicting, they said they're building up a force capable of invasion. We don't know if he's made a decision yet. But he has the capability, he's warning. Eventually, Biden says he has made the decision. And I'll tell you something, as somebody who was in the government, worked for the government at pretty high consultant levels and even official level staff, for over 10 years. No one knows better than I venture to say, how much the government lies and how stupid they can be and how wrong they can be. But I have to say that from an inside point of view, when I heard him say, what would seem impossible to know, that Putin has made the decision to invade, which he said more than about a week before the invasion, I thought to myself, I don't believe he says that without having pretty strong special intelligence, even from a mole in the Kremlin or in their Pentagon, giving them plans. And he had that, I think, months earlier, detailed plans, which hadn't, you know, there was no decision yet, but capability. And I thought he has special intelligence, what they call special intelligence, communications intelligence, which requires a clearance higher than top secret, which I had for years, 60. And the public doesn't know. And when the public says, where's your evidence on this? They can't have evidence that they can't tell. That's true. They lie about it, they make mistakes about it, but they can have it. So I thought, even though friends of mine were saying this is a hoax, by the way, that's what Matloff thought, this is a hoax, and he'd been an ambassador. He knew all, everything I knew for sure, and more about Russia, of course, no comparison. But he's saying it's a hoax, and I was thinking, I can't believe this, I don't think it's a hoax. Might be, but I don't think that they might be in V. Okay, so they were right. The critics were wrong on that point, at that point. Where does that bring us? It does mean that Putin is willing to risk war with the United States. and he's taking a real risk of it. Now, on this point, Biden has been pretty prudent. And he hasn't. He said right at the beginning, which people criticize him for, no U.S. ground troops and no no-fly zone. Now, Zelensky has asked almost every parliament in sight earlier, not now, for a no-fly zone. Seems very plausible. Why do you allow us, the good guys, to be pulverized from the air like missiles and airplanes, and you're not, as Zelensky puts it, closing the air to them? Closing the air. Why not? We've done it before, with or without NATO. Why are we not doing it? And the answer is, Putin is using his nuclear weapons very effectively on this. If he didn't have them, if he didn't have the possibility of preempting our attack and blowing the world up, we would have airplanes all over Ukraine right now. Think what American airplanes could have done to that 40-mile convoy of Russian trucks and tanks. Imagine American air power, cruise missiles, everything else, what they'd do to that. Remember the highway of death in Iraq when the Hussein vehicles were escaping. They were escaping Iraq, and we pulverized, you know, from the air. Napalm, white phosphorus, you know, every kind of thing. CBUs, you know, controlled fragmentation. We're blaming, we're condemning, as you know, we're condemning Putin as a war criminal, among other things, because he's using white phosphorus, a chemical weapon, horrible weapon, controlled fragmentation against personnel. I don't think they've, I haven't heard of napalm yet, actually, but, you know, they're attacking civilians. That's it. See, it made me faint to have people pointing as though nobody else had done this. Why aren't we, how can we bring him to crimes when we don't recognize the International Criminal Court? In part because we have not joined the almost universal ban on controlled fragmentation or anti-personnel mines. Or chemical, I don't know what chemical weapons exactly. Certainly not against white phosphorus. We use them in Iraq. I mention that because I saw white phosphorus victims in Vietnam. And I don't want to think about that before I go to sleep anytime. It's horrible, you know, that stuff burns through the bone. It won't stop burning, you can't put it out. Horrible scars, horrible agony. The Israelis used it in Lebanon. I could see it. As somebody who's seen it in Vietnam, anybody who's seen white phosphorus used, as I have, seen the Israelis using it on buildings in Lebanon because it's beautiful, it's unique. It has plumes of white smoke come out with beautiful scarlet tips on the end. And if it touches your skin, it burns through the bone. You can't put it out with water or sand. So it's vicious. Of course it shouldn't be used. Well, they're using it as we use it. And is it criminal? Yeah, with or without a ban. But, you know, that doesn't make they're using it any better. As I said, you know, we're seeing these civilians killed. And so I actually thought at the beginning of this war, momentarily, could this make people think what happens to civilians under our bombs? But, you know, by now I knew, no, it's not going to, and it hasn't. When 9/11 occurred, the New York Times published, as you remember, page after page of photographs of victims in the World Tower, with little biographies of them. This person liked to play the trombone. This person did magic tricks. This person was very funny, very human. And I thought, this is the first time America has been bombed, in effect, you know, subject to an aerial attack. Maybe this will make them realize what we're doing in these wars. Fat chance, you know. So is it Americans who are so bad? No, unfortunately, as I now see it at 91, Americans are like everybody else here. which means they divide the world into us and them, like every human does. And they don't care that much about what happens to them. People are sufficiently other, and that not us, and that's most of the world. So they're just not concerned about what happens. And when I say that, I don't see that as something changing in a year or two. But if it doesn't, we've had it. And now let me go to I'm just going on lecture, but your initial question, where are we now? Putin's response, his aggressive response to our provocations and challenges in actually talking about or moving toward Ukraine and NATO, which now they're already getting our weapons. What difference does it make if they are in NATO? They're almost in NATO. They're in an enhanced partnership with NATO as of September under Biden. So what's the difference if they go the extra step and actually getting NATO, which we refuse to say would not happen? American bases in Ukraine. American troops, American weapons in Ukraine on the border of Russia. American missiles on the border of Russia. Now, does that really make a difference to Russia? Let me say, as something of an expert on this, no. Any more than Russian IRBMs really made a difference in Cuba. And I was a consultant on that one. And I reported, in effect, to the ex-com, this doesn't make any real difference. That's what McNamara said. There is no security problem here. There is only a political problem because we told them not to do it. That's what McNamara said, as we know in the tapes. Well, I was saying that as somebody who had consulted for McNamara for years. That was true. But we were ready to invade them. They would have blown the world up because they had weapons that we didn't even know they had. Okay. Nuclear weapons. Analogy. As I say, I can't get away from all these analogies because I lived through all of them. Berlin, Cuba, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, the Russians in Syria, the Russians in Afghanistan, etc. I've participated on one side or the other in all of those things. So they are pretty clear in my mind. Don't ask me what I saw as a movie last week at 91 or what I had for dinner last night. But 40 years ago, 10 is all on the edge. I'm pretty good. And I remember all this stuff. Okay, so it was a catastrophe that Putin committed aggression and Ukraine. For the world, obviously for Ukraine to start with, although there are levels of catastrophe. Ukraine is already catastrophic. It can get be a lot worse, and it almost surely will get a lot worse. But for the whole world, committing these crimes on television has made it, I think, an irreversible split between the U.S. and NATO and Russia. When will that change? When will the sanctions be lifted? When will we be other than the pariah state they have now earned? And that means when, and if China does that on Taiwan, same there. And we're all, China's already, in effect, siding with Russia. That may change, but they are. So you've got this split in the world now that we've been moving toward for decades, but didn't really wasn't irreversible. It looks irreversible to me now. And that means that the collaboration that the world needs on climate and on reducing the dangers of nuclear weapons, a global collaboration that is essential, looks to me out of possibility as far as I can see. I've been, as I say, my main obsession has been the Disaster of Nuclear War for 60 years. So, but climate has joined it for me in the last 20 years, though I'm not an expert and I just know what I read. Nuclear needs to make plans. So, can you, without huge cooperation with US and China and India, again, not on our side on this one, Russia, which, as a friend of mine said, might go bankrupt if fossil fuels really are eliminated, because that's their export. So without collaborating on that and somehow compensating for the various losses, climate catastrophes are happening, going to happen. How about reducing the risk of nuclear war, which I've been working on forever since, my life, adult life. No chance of reducing it that I can see. I've been in a campaign explicitly to eliminate ICBMs for several years, the hair triggers on the doomsday machine on both sides. What's the chance of that? It was pretty much zero a year or two ago. But now, irreversible. The new ICBMs, the GBSD, the Ground-Based Strategic Deterrent, they are in. No worry about losing bases in Montana, which the fast food restaurants in the locale rely on to avoid, sell burgers to the people on alert to launch the weapons in 10 minutes. They're safe. The restaurants are safe. Montana is safe. Why North Dakota? Okay. How about no first use? There's a worldwide, has been for half a century, a worldwide movement for no first use. Out of the question now. I've said that for a year. I said, make a little prediction, it's very easy one, it's a very safe one. Biden's nuclear posture review has actually, it seems, been given to Congress recently on a classified basis. And I don't have a clearance now, and nobody has actually leaked to me. But I will predict that when that is released, which could be next week, next month, it will not change our first use threats. It will not have a no first use policy, even though Biden made that a campaign promise that he would. That it would be sole purpose of nuclear weapons to deter nuclear attack, not conventional attack. Our alliances are based on our promise to use nuclear weapons and initiate them in response to a non-nuclear attack. So if NATO gets into this, that threat is right there in Ukraine. What is it? Is Biden going to allow himself to be charged that he is inviting an invasion of Ukraine by reducing this threat? Inviting an invasion of Taiwan by the Chinese? No, he's not going to do that. And we don't know for sure yet, but I'll just say he's not going to do that. So we're going to keep our first use policy. We're going to keep the ICBM. We're going to keep launch on warning. Okay, now, as we see, Putin is now using the same threats. That's what keeps us from responding to Zelensky's requests for a no-fly zone, which would mean, by the way, American air power not only confronting Russian air power in the air, it would mean hitting Russian anti-aircraft, as you know, and surface-to-air missiles. And are you going to, on the ground? And are you going to do that without hitting the cruise missiles? And without hitting, and without eventually American air power hitting the ground troops? Well, why not? Some people are calling for that in Congress. And the why, you know, how can you let Zelensky address a joint session and get a standing ovation and say, please give me this, perfectly reasonable request, except for the reason that Biden is refusing. and that is that would risk, well, that would be war with Russia, NATO war with Russia, which we and NATO could not afford to lose. And it would mean our moving ahead in such a way, you know, as to make it a full war. And second, here, nobody's actually mentioned this, it would be a war we couldn't afford to win locally. Because unlike Vietnam, or any of the others we tried to win and failed, winning in Ukraine would, by all accounts, risk of Putin's using nuclear weapons and getting us into a two-sided nuclear war where everything is at stake. So we shouldn't do that, and we can't do that. I mean, we shouldn't do that. So far, we aren't. So it's a war. The U.S. could not afford, it would be too dangerous for the U.S. to be on the verge of winning that war, because it might blow the world up. And even if it didn't blow the world up, now we're in answer to your question, if Putin did use a nuclear weapon, it would not necessarily blow the world up. It would not even be likely to, in my opinion. People would be cautious enough not to sort of launch the ICBMs on that one. But it would lead to an era, however we responded, where that precedent had been broken. It would be an era of small nuclear wars, which 9 countries can do right now, but about 40 could have the capability to do that within a year. Germany and Russia could have nuclear weapons in weeks, actually, if they wanted to. And other countries, South Korea, Taiwan itself, a whole lot of countries, would then see, wow, even before that happens, these weapons are helping Putin keep the U.S. out, and not having them has prevented Ukraine, which used to have them, from keeping them out. So they're going to be used in the future. We better have them to threaten, for us to threaten, and perhaps for us to launch, if we had to. And our neighbors are going to get them, so we better get them. So an era of proliferation may well be underway already. So on reducing the risks of nuclear war, by the way, our threats are working too. As people haven't noticed sufficiently, Russia hasn't attacked bases in Poland that are supporting Ukraine. And why not? Because Putin doesn't want a two-sided war with the U.S. He risked it. He gambled on that. And so far, he's won. Let's hope he continues to win on that, but he doesn't get a war with NATO.
All right. Well, listen, on that note, we've talked an hour. Your voice must be going at this point. So I think we should say, that this is where we're going to leave it. Let me ask you a quick question. Can I put this online as a actual recorded interview?
Sure, of course.
Okay, thank you.
But I tell you what, I've probably warned you already, not yet. Could we say, let's, for what it's worth, and of course you can edit it any amount you want, which you will, I presume. Though I've noticed I'm speaking a little more syntactically transcribable than I usually do, it seems to me. So, because when I read my transcripts, it's like anybody, it's rather appalling of them. But it says, can take what you want. Let's go another 15 minutes, is that okay?
15 is fine, let's do it.
Even though you can't use it. Say what?
Let's do it. Keep talking.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Let me see if I can finish up a couple of things here that I started. Okay, a big one. Big one. Taiwan is almost, talk of analogies, it's almost an identical situation to Ukraine. And both the Taiwanese and the Chinese have to be drawing lessons from Ukraine hour by hour. And what they are is not entirely clear, you know, but it's very, very analogous. I won't take the time in 15 minutes to spell out all the analogies. But remember, well, just a couple. Putin thinks of Ukraine as part of Russia, right? Russian world. He thinks of Ukraine, which has declared independence, as having illegitimately seceded in times and reflecting a moment of Russian weakness. So from his point of view, he's conducting a civil war, an internal war. He's Lincoln, who doesn't want to accept secession. That's his point of view. What is Xi's point of view of Taiwan? It's absolutely open. It's every leader of China since Mao, from Mao on, has said, and we never contradicted it until a few years ago. Officially, we still don't contradict it. There is one China. Taiwan is a province of China. Taiwan is acting as if it wants to secede from us, but we will not accept that. And they're acting very autonomous, almost like a sovereign state, but they're not recognized by almost anybody. 15 very small nations like Vanuatu, Dominican, I don't know, some Caribbean islands recognize Taiwan as a sovereign state, but we don't, and nor does any other country. Now, what difference would that make? They've said if you move toward declaring independence and gaining independence, as Ukraine claims to have done, and actually has done for 30 years, if you do that, we invade. They've said that for more than half a century. How do I get into this, by the way? I released exactly a year ago, in May last year, a 500 page study, of which about 100 pages are still top secret. A study of the 1958 Komoi crisis, where Eisenhower was prepared that if the Chinese pressed their ongoing artillery barrage of offshore islands, Komoi and Matsu, with some of them a mile and a half from the Chinese mainland, if they did that, we would initiate nuclear war against the Chinese with the expectation, this is in the top secret part that I released, the study was done in 66, but I've had it since 69 when I copied it. And I have actually put it out before, but not very, it didn't get the headlines. Eisenhower did that in the expectation that the Soviets would respond with nuclear weapons, destroying Taiwan, destroying Okinawa, where our bases were, destroying Guam. And what I knew that meant at that time was armed conflict with the Soviet Union unleashes our strategic air command and our tactical command. That armed conflict would do it that Eisenhower was expecting if the Chinese kept bombing, kept artillery barraging, would result in our hitting every city in Russia and China. Why China, if, for example, the Russians moved on Berlin or Yugoslavia? Answer, we don't want to get destroyed on two sides for US and Russia and leave China unscathed, running the world. That's been our policy every year for the last 70 years or so. China is going to go if there's war with Russia. And I thought I'd change that in 61, working for McNamara, and I hadn't. McNamara gave it, they were supposed to make an option that you could leave off China, attacks on China, if you were having a conflict with Russia. Didn't, the plans didn't change. I thought I had written in an option in 61 for McNamara that cities in Russia and the satellites could be spared while you attacked military targets. We were fooled. I was fooled. I failed. The Air Force never, we now know, never changed its targeting. It just relabeled them. The targets were labeled for military targets in cities. So the cities would go, not the cities per se. Okay. I failed on all these attempts inside to change the policy. Now we come back to Taiwan. And again, as I say, it's the same situation. Just as for 1993, 1994, 1995, we have moved toward recognizing Ukraine as part of NATO, which Russia has always said, even when it was the Soviet Union, Russia has always said, that's a red line. You know, we cannot allow those missiles on our border or our bases any more than the U.S. would allow Russian missiles in Cuba. It's the same. We wouldn't allow it. So we moved toward it. We gambled on that for all this time. And the gamble now, did it fail or did it succeed? It's been a total bonus for our position in Europe, for the unification of NATO, which was getting obsolete, which was obsolete, totally obsolete. Now it isn't. Sales have boomed, the budget has boomed, the military, industrial, congressional, media, academic, think tank, intelligence, financial, oil complex is blossoming and will continue to. Eliminate ICBMs that I've been trying to do now for years. That ship has sailed. And it has sailed into iceberg waters at full speed at night. Just like the Titanic, which didn't have to go down, could have missed the iceberg, but was likely to go down. On climate, I think we've hit the iceberg. I think this civilization is going to go down from climate. I hope I'm wrong. And I've often been wrong, so fine. That's a good basis for hope. But at the moment, I don't see any way to avert the increase in fossil fuel emissions. Increase, not decrease, before 2030 or 2050. It's not going to go away, it's going to go up. Well, that tells us it's not going to be, we're not going to achieve 1.5 or 2 degrees. That ship, again, has sailed long ago. 2.5, 3, 3.5. I think we've hit the iceberg on that. Pretty bad. And so here's, let's come down to what could we possibly hope in this to achieve. Well, we should stop provoking China toward invasion of China, of Taiwan, with the nuclear risks that involves. Just that we should have stopped pretending that we were going to put Ukraine NATO. We couldn't resist that for a number of reasons, maybe to get just what we have, but at least to sell them a lot of weapons, even if it didn't cause a war. And now it's even better. If the war stays at this level, perfect forever. I believe, now here's what, it's good we're going on here for a few minutes because it's important to say this. I have a strong belief from what I've read that the U.S. with its special forces has been preparing Ukraine for an insurgency since at least 2015. They never expected them to hold out this long against the Russians, but when the Russians did succeed in occupying, because they didn't want bases on their border, U.S. bases, the Ukrainians are prepared to fight a guerrilla war in certain states. We've been preparing for them and giving them good weapons for it. The javelins are very good weapons for them. Their tactics are good, except I've been on the counterinsurgency side of that war. Let me say, I believe that there are dominant elements in our administration and in the military complex that look forward to an indefinitely long guerrilla war with first supply. And if the Ukrainians choose that, well, that's their right. Just like the Mujahideen. What the Mujahideen got when we supplied them with surface-to-air missiles, like the Javelin, was 1 million dead, or 1.5 million dead. I think it was a vile, wicked policy for us to try to bleed the Soviets in Afghanistan for 10 years to bleed them for a number of reasons and at the cost of a million Afghans. And what did we say we were doing? What Brzezinski, National Security Advisor, said he had told Carter on the night Russia invaded, Christmas Eve, December 24th, 1979. Now we can give the Russians their Now we can give the Soviets their Vietnam. And we did. We did. They lost 15,000 troops. The Ukrainians had their Vietnam, and they lost a million. Just as the Vietnamese, when I was a counterinsurgent, and the U.S. was bombing Vietnam, caused between 2 and 4 million dead in 30 years. Now, the Russians took 10 years to do that. We battled Taliban with no legitimation, no legitimacy. Not good guys from our point of view, and certainly not white Christians. How many did we kill in Afghanistan? I don't know. I haven't seen a good estimate. Apparently less than the Russians did. But then the Russian tactics against an insurgency in Chechnya was to level Grozny the way they're doing now in Ukraine. We've seen that already before. As far as I know, the Russians, by the way, they think we encouraged that one. I don't know. But we did encourage the Russians to try to put down an insurgency that we were supporting for 10 years in Afghanistan. And as I say, a million died. I think there are many Americans in the military-industrial complex and in the civilian administration who look forward. They don't want to see a nuclear war, but they look forward to bleeding Russia for 10 years, 20 years. Our high military have actually uttered those words, 10 or 20 years. Just like Afghanistan, that happened. At the cost of how many Ukrainians? We want to see the Ukrainians fight to the last Ukrainian, as people have said. That's not a rhetorical, wild, cynical comment. That's a pretty good description of what our policy is, unless we negotiate. So I'd say it is wicked to fail to discourage in any way Zelensky. If he wants to make concessions to end this war, to save Ukrainian lives, it would be wicked not to encourage him to do that, but it would be wicked to discourage that or to oppose it in any way, whatever concessions he and the Ukrainians can make in the Donbas and elsewhere about who wrote that. And that's what I think we're preparing to do. Well, the same in Taiwan. Trump was the first president to receive in his Oval Office to accept a phone call from the president of Taiwan, the current president, singly. Just an ordinary call, except we'd never done that before because it made it look like a call between heads of state, which I just read in a book by Elizabeth. I was just reading it today, Xi Jinping. He says that, he quotes sources, and he says that call had been arranged for well in advance. It was before he took office. It was in December. It was a month after the election. I'm sorry, the arrangement. He took the congratulatory call in December. It had never been done before. Obama and Biden have continued to have official visits on a level was not permitted since 1979 under Carter when we recognized Beijing as ruler. So in other words, we are clearly moving toward recognizing him. To me, that's insane. I can't think of any reason for doing that, that anybody would see a silver lining in that, except people who want to sell more weapons to Taiwan than they are currently allowed to do. And some people in the Pentagon may want to have back the bases that we had from 49 to 79, 30 years. I visited those bases for the Pentagon in 59. And we had bases, we had nuclear weapons, we had planes, we had missiles. They all went in 79. A couple dozen Marines have gone back now for the first time in the last couple of years. That's very little. But China has said that's a red line for us, and they've said that as clearly as every Russian leader since Yeltsin has said Ukraine is a red line for us. And we're approaching that red line. Now, do we want war with Taiwan? I think in the first instance, China, we want to sell them weapons. We, you know, I'd say we, the North Industrial Company, wants to sell them weapons. Otherwise, I don't know, some Taiwanese want an official office in the UN and to be able to vote in the General Assembly, not the Security Council. Whereas now they have an unofficial office. Just what risk of world war or Taiwan being annihilated is worth that benefit? Well, it's the way humans do. Humans in office, humans in power. I think it is a species problem, and it has really come to bite us in the era of nuclear weapons and climate change. Empires could get away with populations increasing year by year, despite their wars, for 4,000 years since Sumer and Akkad, let alone the Egyptians and the Romans and everybody else, the Persians. The population grows, we had growth and so forth, till our technology got to a point in my lifetime. I was born in 31. Szilard patents a chain reaction in 33, 2 years, when I was two. In 39, he encouraged Einstein to write a letter for a Manhattan Project, which doesn't get started. I was eight. The bomb drops when I'm 14. All these other wars that I mentioned, it's my lifetime. It's the nuclear era. Most of the carbon in the air is not just since my lifetime, it's in the last 30 years, more than half of it, going up all the time. So humanity has never been very concerned about the preservation of its species any more than any other animal is. One animal cares about the preservation of its species. And moreover, what animal cares about most other beavers or wild geese or bears or whatever in the world any more than we do? The problem is they didn't threaten to destroy them. They didn't have the population to destroy all those other members of their species that they didn't care about. And we do. Our ability to destroy now and our readiness, our preparation, our sales of ability to destroy most of our species have simply not existed for any other reason. And that's where we are. And I think that, to finish off here, I think that this invasion, which was never certain and never necessary and could have been averted, has now shut the door on escaping the traps we've laid for our species. It will not lead to extinction, either climate or even nuclear winter, probably, but it will lead to the murder of billions of people. And that means what I've been working on, but you know, who cares on that? That doesn't matter. But I've become a, what's the word, self-hating human. I love humans. I love a lot of individual humans. I love humanity, even at their worst, in terms that I wanted to go on. I would like it to go on. Some fraction of it will go on. But I'm not wonderfully happy about that, because it will be a species that has extinguished 90% of its own species and all of most other large species. More than half of the life on Earth, biomass of the Earth, vegetable and animal, is microscopic. And most of that will remain. And we came out of that eventually. And the dinosaurs went 65, 67 million years ago. And we came out of that. We didn't exist before that. So, okay, 1% of the amount of the humans will survive, maybe. You know, well, that's 80 million people. Well, that gets you back to after Sumer. Your civilizations, well, civilizations. But it'll be a species that did this. And it will have inherited all the technology that led to this. So, about that, I don't care whether they survive or not, but I do care about the billions that are now at risk and possibly doomed. And no. I'm going to avert that, not just postpone it, but avert it. That's not impossible. One last thing, the nation leaders need to hear, and people to the left of the nation, even more. More than nation years, and that is to have a Republican-controlled Congress after November, which will almost assure a Republican White House in 2024, will shut the door to escape from these tracks even more than it is now. It's kind of the end. Not right away, but can you imagine climate? Can you imagine worldwide cooperation? Can you imagine reducing the risk of nuclear war with the Republican administration in the U.S. of A? It's only one country, but it's the country that is decisive on these things. Can any of that happen while we continue to regard China and Russia as impossible partners for collaboration and negotiation? No, it can't. So, is there something we can do? Yeah. Yeah. There is nothing more important as a movement in the world, I would say, than trying to avert a Republican Congress this year in November and a Republican president in 24, however bad the Democrats might be, however bad they are. I agree with Noam Chomsky 100% on this. And a lot of other people could say, what? What? You know, what's the difference, etc.? That's crazy. So, does that give us any assurance of escape? No, absolutely not. But the opposite is something that really should be avoided. And we should not, actually, Nancy Pelosi, as Speaker of the House, should not be going to Taiwan this year. But she almost surely will be. Maybe that could be avoided, but probably not. Leave it at that. Don't press that she does not assure the Taiwanese that they're moving toward formal recognition of independence. That assures a war in Asia like the war in Ukraine right now. That one you can avoid. And I would say to discourage U.S., to encourage the U.S. to discourage Zelensky from bring this war to an end sooner rather than later, not next year, not 10 years from now, is terrible. It's terribly misguided. It's almost sure to happen, but not 100% sure. And is Putin ready to do that now? Almost surely not. He's not. What'll he be? What if the Russians, what if the Ukrainians in the Donbass discourage his efforts there? Let me change it. He may be willing to make some kind of deal, which he isn't now. So we have these things to work for, and we should do what we can. I will be.
All right. Well, Daniel, on that note, I'm going to say thank you very much. This was a fabulous interview. Very depressing, obviously, but really, really informative. Thank you very much for this.